little in there.
We got that. We got that.
Bruce, I don't know where mine is at the moment.
You got the history books going on? Okay. Are we ready? Hi, Dan. Good morning. I think we can get going here, huh? About ready? Hey, Steve is here. All right. So, good morning and welcome to our huge agenda of April 11th, which everyone's excited about going back to work as soon as possible, but we got to get going. And there's never a dull moment for a chair story, but grandpas have such great wisdom, you know? And so what do grandpas do? You know, fortunately, they still drive, so they take great-grandpa to doctor's appointments, hair appointments, and nail appointments, right? That's part of their role in life. Hopefully they can do it forever or go off the road together. Whatever. I shouldn't say that. Don't record
you
it,
are
please.
On the record,
So, Sunday, we're having a big Easter dinner, and so we got into what's going on for the grandkids. I asked them, what you doing this week for Mama? Well, I got to take her to hair. I got to take her to nails. But he says, you know, them damn places stink. He says, I do my Sudoku, but I think, you know, I've worked in pesticides all my life. I'm 89 years old and didn't kill me. He says, I think that crap in those nail salons is going to kill me. And guess what? Yesterday's paper comes out. He's right. It's like, see, great grandpas have wisdom. They know bad nail salons and bad hair salons. So I know it has an impact on females in the world, but he has appointments this week at the same place. So I told him, get one of those respirators like you used to wear for the DDT in the good old days. So. Anyway, so we better move on to roll call, and we actually have introductions today too, but just hopefully you have great grandpas in the world and they do have wonderful wisdom. And hopefully they keep driving forever too. Oh. Otherwise I won't be here.
Scary thought.
All right, Mary, please. Here.
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 Here. And I think we have some.
We do have some.
Tam
staff
is here today too, yeah. Right, Tam? Up there. Yeah. There she is. Good seeing you.
We do have two staff introductions. So I'd like Naomi Fager and Mary Rose Cassidy
to come forward with their introductions or introductees, as the case may be.
Good morning, Chair Muller, members of the board, Naomi Fager, the Chief of the Planning Division, Planning TMTLs. I want to introduce today our newest member of our division, Kevin Lundy. He has a PhD from UC Berkeley in Environmental Science Policy and Management. Did his dissertation on investigations into altered aquatic ecosystems. And he brings to us expertise in aquatic ecology, hydrology, river restoration, and water quality monitoring. He's going to be working as our swamp coordinator. And a couple other things he's going to be doing is working to help us develop biological water quality objectives for our perennial and non-perennial streams. He'll be working on the statewide project as well as regionally. And working with the Regional Monitoring Coalition, our storm response to our stormwater municipal regional permit, developing the stormwater monitoring program. And also helping with TMDLs, working on our freshwater nutrient TMDLs, both in the Sonoma and Sonoma Creek and Napa River. So we welcome him. We know he's going to be a great addition. He and his wife had a new baby. He finished his dissertation, and he was working with Karen Tversky on the swamp program under contract. So we know he can handle an awful lot, and we're going to be throwing a lot at him. So please welcome him.
Congratulations. Thank you. Welcome.
Good morning, Chairman Miller and board members. I'm Mary Rose Cassa. I'm a section leader in the Toxics Cleanup Division. I am erfreut, that is, delighted, to introduce Dr. Uta Hellman-Bloomberg. She signed on yesterday in the Toxics Division. She was hired on as an environmental scientist to serve as our in-house toxicology and risk assessment specialist. She worked with us as a volunteer for 6 months in 2011, helping to update our environmental screening levels, which are risk-based recommendations used to screen brownfields and other contaminated properties. Uta grew up in the hydrologic hotspot at the confluence of the Rhine and Mosel rivers in Germany and Koblenz. She's lived in the U.S. since 1986. Her background includes cancer research and college-level teaching. Her interests and hobbies outside of work include gardening, cooking, hiking, and camping. So please welcome Uta.
Welcome. It's just wonderful to have such highly qualified people to come on board for all of us, really. It's just congratulations. And
it's scary. I couldn't get a job.
That's right.
Some of us who only have masters probably wouldn't be hired.
How about high school? I guess I better stay as a farmer, right? It's wonderful, and I know everyone's worked so hard to get to these positions, and well-deserved, and stick with us. You'll soon be all sitting at the front tables up here. We'll all be moved on somewhere else. So,
and I'm also pleased to announce that Keith Roberson, who you may recall last month made presentation on the United Technologies site, he's just been promoted to section leader in the groundwater division, and we're pleased to be able to do promotions. It's been a long time coming, so we are able to do limited hires and limited promotions, and we're trying to do as much as that we can during this fiscal year, because come July 1, you never know what happens.
And we have our state board member, Tam. Welcome. Nice seeing you.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm happy to be here, especially on a day when we get introductions of new staff. It's been a very long time. Congratulations. They sound like two very, very excellent additions to the Water Boards, especially the graduates from Cal Berkeley. Yay!
Now.
Well, good morning. I wanted to give you a brief update on a couple of things that are coming before the State Water Board, a couple of things that are, I think, way overdue, and so I'm very glad to get them closer to the finish line, shall we say. First, there is our policy for the siting, design, operation, and maintenance of septic systems. The revised draft policy was just released a few weeks ago. The board is scheduled to have a hearing on it on May 2nd, and board consideration will be on June 19th. And I'm looking forward to hopefully bringing that one across the finish line, because, like I said, it's been a long time in making. But the latest revised policy is much, much different than the previous one, and I think it addresses a lot of the concerns that local county health officials have, as well as some regional boards. I don't know about this one. In terms of creating more of a risk-based, tiered approach to the issue of septic systems. Speaking of risk-based, our risk-based low-threat underground storage tank policy is scheduled for Tuesday before the Water Board as a hearing, and possible adoption will be on May 1st. Also, just released, I believe on Friday, is our revised construction stormwater general permit. If you'll recall, in December of 2011, the Sacramento Superior Court issued a judgment in BIA versus the State Water Board. And as part of that judgment and the writ of mandate that came out of that decision, the draft construction stormwater permit will remove the numeric effluent limits for pH and, I'm drawing a blank, turbidity, and replace them with receiving water monitoring trigger. And as you can imagine, that judgment will probably have some impacts as well on our industrial stormwater permit and the other stormwater permits that are in the pipeline. And speaking of that pipeline, I've been advised by my staff this morning that they will be releasing the draft Caltrans stormwater permit this month, and scheduled for releasing the revised industrial general stormwater permit by mid-May, and the revised small MS4 permit by the end of May. And all of those are scheduled for workshops and hearings in June and July. And State Board staff did brief State Board members recently on those permits, and the only thing I will say is you'll also see that those have also been revised tremendously as well. And I'm sure we'll all look forward to hearing comments on those. Also wanted to give you a heads up on another matter that is being presented to the State Water Board on Tuesday as an informational item, though it's garnered a lot of interest already. In October of last year, as part of the very painful task of raising fees by, I think it was like $22.8 million, the State Water Board instructed staff to do an analysis of how those fees are distributed amongst the various waste discharge permit funded programs, how the distribution of those fees and funds relate or align with priorities, and how do they link with performance measures and targets for these various programs. This is just the first, preliminary step toward, I hopefully will be, a longer-term effort towards looking at how we set priorities, how we look at fees and funds, and hopefully make sure that they align with the priorities that we set. And so the draft, there's a draft report now that is on our website. If you go to the State Board Water Board website and look at our calendar and agenda for Tuesday, there is a link there to that item. I believe it's item number six. No, five. Sorry, item number five. And so the staff will be presenting it as a draft report. And this was phase one of something that the board directed staff to do. Phase two would be to, now that staff has done an evaluation, to reach out to our stakeholders and gather input and see where we go from here, how can we improve in these areas, one of the things that I found very interesting in the 50-page report is the discussion of prioritization and how we prioritize, and it's a very intriguing reading, and it, for me, triggers the flag that we do need to do a better job, one, at setting criteria for prioritizing our activities, and two, being able to coordinate and communicate more efficiently with each other as well as our stakeholders on that aspect. There are lots of data that is presented by staff. One of the things that I find also very intriguing but also a bit disheartening is if you remember in 2000, the water boards as a whole did a needs assessment, and in 2000 we demonstrated that the resources we had at that time were inadequate for us to fulfill all of our various responsibilities and obligations. And since then, our resources have actually been reduced. In the WDPF-funded program, our staff resources has been reduced by 12%, and in general, overall, by 15%. So we were already in the hole in 2000, and we're even in a bigger hole now, which I think does, again, reinforce the need to have a discussion of prioritization, a discussion of where we need to focus our resources, and acknowledge where we're not able to focus resources, what we're not able to do because of these various constraints that we all face. And so it's a fascinating report. It's a draft. It's a first step in my mind. It's nowhere near complete, and this has been done mainly in-house, so our stakeholders have not had a chance to weigh in and provide thoughts and comments. So I look forward to moving further down this road, but I think it is a very important effort for all of us, and I know that you are also starting some discussion in that area, and I congratulate you for taking that step and offer whatever assistance I and State Board staff can provide to help you in that effort as well.
Good. Any questions or comments for Tim?
May I ask Dr. a question? Well, I think the money, raising money and distributing, that's important, but I have a question about septic tank.
Uh-huh.
My personal experience, a friend of mine lives in Santa Cruz Hills, and he invited me one time, long time, maybe 20 years ago, for dinner. And then I found on the slopes, there is a mantle of soil along the side of the hill, and they have homes, one after another, down the slope, and they have septic tank below, and they have a well above them. And they release the septic tank, come to the next home, and they have a well, and then down below they have septic tank. And I just went into the well and look at it, where do you get the water? That time the bottled water system was not there. So,
did you ask him how often he monitors his drinking water well?
Well, they were monitoring, they're putting chlorine, and it was oozing out. I said, I'm not going to drink water here, because, you know, is there some kind of management of that kind of affair? Because those people are immune to that water. They will not get sick. But I thought I will get sick.
So I don't know about that.
This is a real story of my life. So, as your concern, hopefully you addressed that question in septic tank policy you have come out with, and thank you for that.
Okay. Thank you.
They were the first recyclers. We kind of lived that. We kind of lived that on our farm too. Trust me. We do try to have a separation of our septic system and our wells, but you know, who knows? But we do drink bottled water. So I think that concludes any comments there, and we will move on to the next item agenda in the public forum. I do not have any cards at this time. And we're actually pretty thin on cards today, which is kind of encouraging. Moving on to item three, minutes of the April 13th, 2011 meeting.
Move approval.
Moved and second. All in favor?
Oh, one thing I'm going to.
All right.
I'm going to abstain because I wasn't present at the April 2011 meeting.
April 13th, Steve.
All right. Okay. Yes.
Okay. All in favor? One abstention, except for Board Member Moore. And moving on to item four, the Chair's report. And it was a busy week. I get my papers all together here. In March 26, we had the first in a long time, it's been some time since we've gotten together as chairs in Sacramento. Excuse me. And so we had kind of each region had an update. We had almost all the regions there. I will encourage anyone that ever gets involved in a chair's conference call, if you can't make the meeting, don't call in, because we had one of our wonderful chairs call in. And every time board member Hoppin spoke, her dog barked. And so we got to hear that. And then the kids were yelling. So it was quite interesting. It's like, put it on mute, you know. But all the chairs were there. And I think everyone's kind of almost dealing with the same things other than the great work our board and staff are doing here. And we had a working lunch, and then our Cal EPA Secretary Rodriguez and Under Secretary Burns came in and visited quite lengthy with us and had good discussions and talked a lot about the working relationship. I asked the question, working relationship with U.S. EPA Regional 9 Administrator here in the Bay Area, and everything seems to be going well there. And we had an update and overview on the groundwork, groundwater strategy work, and we have our first concept paper draft out there that I don't know if everyone has copies of, but it's getting going there. And then the nitrate issue. And then we were discussing our fall WQCC meeting coming up November 1st and 2nd. Is that correct, Bruce?
Yes.
And we were looking at some of the talking points, and Tam mentioned one. The water board funding was pretty high on our priority discussion list there. And the other is always the legal update by Michael Lauffer, because there's so many new board members in the system out there. The other is non-point source land use-based pollution control and the Southern Delta salinity objectives and the desalinization policy. And so those were some of the topics that we're trying to put together for November 1st and 2nd. And so what else did we have? Our priorities for Region 2 we talked about, and Bruce could discuss those quickly. So I think that's all I have, and then we can start with Board Member Moore.
Well, thank you, Chair Mueller. Real briefly, I don't have anything to report from this past month. Just in highlighting the executive officer's report, and Bruce, of course, will report. I appreciate the focus on vessels in the bay. There's not an easy fit with our regulatory system and the issues that are complex and diverse as far as abating water pollution and with derelict vessels and other issues, social and otherwise. So I appreciate the focus of staff on that issue. It's visible. It's unique to our region. It's important for our agency to have a presence in those discussions. And also I point out another item that I really support is to enforce the requirements of the municipal regional permit for stormwater on municipalities. There's a proposed settlement for the County of Alameda, failure to implement new and redevelopment provisions. I think it's important. There was a very colossal enterprise for this board and its staff to set up that permit a couple of years ago, and we need to enforce its provisions to have credibility. And that's it. It's good to see my fellow board members. It's April. Thank you.
Board Member Singh, I know you've been on world travels to the homeland.
Yes, I went for a week to Delhi, and I came back from Delhi. I came back on 14th, but I came in the evening, so I missed the last month meeting. Well, I tell you that I was well received over there, and I enjoyed the trip. It was a very short trip. I won't go into it. But let me say a few things I have in my mind, a couple of items. One item is I was reading a story about cap and trade. The state of California right now is running a deficit of $9 billion. And they're talking if the cap and trade comes in, it will start from $3 to $4 billion, and annual income for a state could be as much as $15 billion. But there are restrictions how you can use the money, and the legislature has to pass some legislation that how to allocate, how to administer, and some people say that that money should only be used for environmental purpose. And there are a lot of discussion I was reading about advantages and disadvantages, how to use, what kind of legislation should be there, where the money should go. Environmentalists are saying that all that money should be plowed back into regions and used for environmental improvements. And some people are saying they can use for other purposes also. There is a deficit of maybe education and other things. So that's one interesting subject coming up, and it will be probably taken up by legislature in next year or so. So please keep your eye open on cap and trade business coming up. A second thing I would like to talk about, I spent my whole life after getting my degree from Stanford and in education. I've been in education, and some of the things I was reading a story this morning that there is a Antioch Medical High School. I don't know what it is. Medical High School I never heard of. And they have a very strict grading system, and a lot of apes are given in the classes, and some of the parents kind of complaining that the children are running into depression because of the very strict grading system. So they changed some of the F to D. I don't know how good it is, but so under pressure. But I recall a story that during my 40 years plus of being in teaching line, I found that for some reason or other, the quality of students has declined in this country. I don't know. I started, and we used to have a much more stricter teaching standard, and we cover more materials. And slowly, as the time went on, I find the mathematical teaching, and with all the efforts and all the tutoring and everything provided, and especially in American students, I'm not talking general, there are some bright students, but a lot of lethargyness, maybe because the life has become much more easier, that each one of them have to date every night, and each one of them, I think education is kind of a storage system, but for a time being, they have to really have a rigorous training, and we had to cut down on the syllabus to accommodate during the semester. We had to slow down, and the standard went down. And what happened, the broader system that is students will grade you or they will evaluate your teaching style, so many people just go easy a little bit because the young professors who are not promoted yet, they are in a assistant professor level or instructor level, they want promotion, they want to have a good grading from students. Also, cheating came into the classes. I noticed that they were very ethical when I started teaching, but in this country, maybe due to infusion of the foreign students, cheating started in the classrooms. And something is wrong with our high school system, or I think it is wrong with our parents. I don't think the teachers can do everything. And I was very much concerned. I raised this issue many places. And I'll tell you one story and I'll stop it on this. A professor, Dr. William Laurel, very high class, first class structural engineer, he was from Austria. He was teaching a class. He was a professor there. He's no longer living, a fantastic man. And he one time started very first year freshman level class called statics. He taught. His class started with 33 students. By the time of the dropout period was over, there were 13 students left in his class. He was so strict, but he was a great professor. And then when the final came, he gave 11 F and 2 D. So out of 13, that is standard. All of them appealed to the president and all the fairness committee. A fairness committee is too strict. So they forced that he said he will, president ordered him, he went through all the process, fairness committee, that he change the grade and reevaluate it. He refused to do that. I said, I will not change it. These people don't belong in engineering, and I will not change it. So he refused, and completely refused it. I said, I will not change it. A president overrode him and changed all those 13 grades to C. So this tells you a story about it, that how things run. So I think something we should worry about the future of this country, and environment comes also from the people. A lot of PhDs, at that time, not when I graduated, there were fewer PhDs people. Right now, there are manufacturing companies that produce PhD after PhD. There are huge quantity of people like that. The value has gone down. But I'm not saying that their quality is bad. So I'm kind of concerned about education. I think it impacts in every sphere of our life. And I don't know what we can do about it. And thank you very much for listening to me.
I'll try to compare that a little bit to strict grading that our wastewater industry is going through, right? So they probably feel they're getting strictly graded by us on their trying to meet their limits all the time. So we'll kind of compare it that way. It's a tough one. But you solve that problem, Dr. Singh, you won't be sitting here. You'll be in the White House, trust me. We'll make you the king if we can figure that system out. But thank you for that.
Thank
Vice Chair?
That
yes, I have just one meeting to report on this month. Yesterday I met with Dr. Mike Connor. Always a pleasure. We had an enjoyable time talking about the regional board's potential roles in addressing the challenges posed by the chemicals of emerging concern, or the chemicals of already concern, as the case may be. And then also talking about the need for better planning and more long-term investments in infrastructure. Dr. Connor made the point, which was which many of us know subliminally, but is always worth repeating, that the sewage treatment infrastructure is sort of nearing the end of its lifespan. The stuff that was built under the Clean Water Act in the first wave, and so we have challenges to meet as the current system, the current structures age, but also we're putting potentially greater demands on the systems. Perhaps our financial planning has not kept up with what's going to be the future challenge in this area, and I know that we all think a lot about infrastructure, and this is yet one more example of how we need to keep trying to do a better job of making sure that we have the financial wherewithal and the resources to do what needs to be done when the time comes. That's it for meetings. I did want to highlight or ask a question in advance about the executive officer's report, or shall I wait until Bruce reports on it? And then you can respond as part of your report. It has to do with the cleanup of derelict vessels. And I note that you said, which was great news, that to allow expedited cleanup for future situations, we're trying to work to set up an on-call contract so that we could respond without going through the contracting procedures. But I wasn't clear on whether we would still have to spend the time necessary to get the funding from the cleanup and abatement account. And if the answer to that question is yes, whether it would be possible for us to pursue having a reserve set aside in the cleanup and abatement account so that we would be able to grab those funds quickly, implement the contract quickly, and actually perhaps get to the point where
exactly
we can respond so quickly.
That's exactly what we're trying to accomplish, because we did find doing the contract through the cleanup and abatement account did take so long that if we were able to set that up in advance and have that more as an on-call. The challenge is obviously with the cleanup and abatement account, it's not necessarily viewed as free money. The idea is that if we're going to access that account, we still want to go back and try to determine who are the responsible parties and whether they can replenish the account. And sometimes that slows down some of the process. But nonetheless, we did find in the example cited in the executive officer's report, we felt we had a very urgent need, and there was certainly agreement on use of the cleanup abatement account as the source of the funding. It was just getting through the contracting. And so that's what we're trying to get over the hump and use our lessons learned as a way to move forward and set it up better for the future.
Very important work, and I hope we're able to be successful in doing that. And thank you very much for pursuing it.
Great, thank you. Very important. Shalom.
I think this board should, at about time, to recognize Bill Peacock services to the board. We talked about it several times, but nothing done. I suggest that next time, next meeting, we call Bill Peacock and present him with some kind of certificate.
That's a good idea.
We will definitely...
Maybe we'll make that a motion. It's a motion.
I'll second it.
Maybe a certificate and lunch.
Yeah, and lunch, yes. Yeah. And have all lunch together.
I think we have to do it. It's now or never, right?
Yes, that's right.
Because the months go by, so...
It's time.
It's time. So let's work on May. I don't...
Yeah.
So you got the point of the motion and the second. And all in favor, aye. We'll make it a quick motion, but you're right on. Thank you, Board Member. Board Member McGrath.
Two things. I appreciate Dr. Young's comments about derelict vessels. I sit in the Waterfront Commission in Berkeley, and I asked the waterfront manager there kind of how he sees things coming. And in a recreational marina where your business is the revenue, they see them coming. And there are a lot of due process requirements. But a good marina manager, and he is one, can see this coming. But that doesn't necessarily exist in, say, the Port of Richmond, where your business is mostly commercial, and where the Tiger. Now, I haven't talked to the Port of Richmond. I don't know to what degree they had oversight. But it also doesn't exist in anchor outs. So kind of one of the things that we need to look at is what's the institutional capacity that's there and not there. But I appreciate, I think we need to put that into our kind of how does this rate in the priority system, and to do that we need to understand it. So that's my second point. As I have been poking around a little bit on strategic planning questions with people, I've talked to David Lewis, and I've given the set of questions to Jason over at the Baykeeper, and I talked some to Tam, and we come, I think, to the same kind of understanding that it's a real challenge to look at resource alignment with priorities, both in terms of an understanding of what the work is in front of us, the restrictions on funding, and different ideas. I also managed to talk to Andy Katz and John Coleman, and I'm working on getting time with Reiner and Alexis and kind of pursuing it in that way. I'm not going to tell you anything about that except one sense of what happens, and that's the resource alignment question. As we deal with less resources, it's not simply that you don't have the resources to do things, but you don't have the expertise, you don't have the upward mobility, and you have questions with who does what kind of work, as to what kind of training you're building into your staff for the long-term development of staff. We were over at the East Bay Mud Treatment Plant, and it was really nice because they're now generating more energy than they're requiring. But I knew right away from my experience in the Clean Water Program that it was a well-run sewage treatment plant. I mean, I wasn't on site for more than a minute or two, and I knew that. And I could not have done that without a lot of site visits. So while we may try to align resources such that the baykeeper tries to get us resources, the baykeeper works under the private attorney general concept, I think we need to keep the larger picture of what kind of staff are we developing and training for the long term, and having a certain amount of field experience and trying to understand some of the unintended consequences of utilizing EPA and their contractors versus our own staff. And so these are things that don't immediately appear on the horizon when you realize you don't have enough resource. But thoughtful comments by Tam and Alexis and David, I think, pointed out that there's a little deeper understanding about how you train an organization for the long term. So I think when I collect enough information and bring it back, we have a discussion that we'll try to organize it so we can have some high buttons to talk about and think about approaches. It's fascinating to me. That's all.
Very good. And Bruce?
A number of things.
While you're speaking, I'm going to shut this door. This noise is bugging me here.
Yeah, okay. Following up on Jim's note that we were at the East Bay Mud Wastewater Treatment Plant over by the maze, by the San Francisco Bay Bridge Toll Plaza, we were over there last week for dedication of a gas turbine. What's a gas turbine doing at a wastewater treatment plant? Well, they have gotten to the point that they've been able to not only harness all of the gas from various treatment processes on site, but they are accepting additional food wastes and other organic material and have developed a system so that they're using the turbine to now generate more energy at their wastewater treatment plant than they need to use on site. So they are actually the first wastewater treatment plant in the nation to be putting energy back on the grid. And so this is very significant. It really shows, again, that wastewater really is a resource, that wastes such as biosolids and others that we always said, oh, let's get rid of them, can be converted into energy. There is energy value in everything that goes through the wastewater treatment plant. And so that's part of looking at the strategic planning, as Dr. Young mentioned, in terms of infrastructure investments. How can we tie into the fact that we have the opportunities as we upgrade our infrastructure or even rebuild our infrastructure that we can get benefits, not just view wastewater as a waste, that there's the benefit there to tap into that energy and reuse the water for many ways. I think this may even tie into the presentation we'll have from San Francisco shortly. So that was very, very heartening to see the progress being made there. I do appreciate the comments on the vessel work that's been noted in the executive officer's report. A lot of staff have been putting a lot of time into this, and it is something that we recognize, as Jim McGrath mentions, what's the institutional capacity to deal with this, because it has been a challenge, much as we saw few years back with the mothball fleet. I mean, it was sort of something that everybody said, oh, there it is, somebody's dealing with it. Well, as much in the same way with boats or, you know, anchor outs, everybody sort of says, well, somebody's dealing with it. In most cases, no. Nobody is dealing with it. And so we have to look at how we best plug that into our prioritization, because it is a challenging area. And there is not always a clear-cut regulatory means to address these, as we've found. So we'll continue to look at the best ways to approach that. I also appreciate Steve Moore's comment on the enforcement on the Alameda County stormwater program. I think the staff has done a lot of work, as reported on the item, to reach settlements with a number of dischargers on past enforcement actions, and so we have those out for comments. Especially pleased that we have a number of folks who had late submittals of their annual industrial stormwater report that we're able to address through the settlement process, because we know in years past it's been very painful to go through and have those in front of the board to consider, whereas we've been able to reach settlements on those. So staff has been doing a lot of work to get those resolved, and I think good progress has been made. I also like to note that we've had a number of discussions recently with a variety of parties on wet weather issues. In other words, the excess flows that get into the sanitary sewer system during wet weather. The board is part with EPA, overseeing consent decree with East Bay MUD and East Bay Communities. And, a lot of work has gone into evaluating what can be done over the next 6 months to 6 to 9 months. East Bay MUD and the communities are tasked to come up with a recommended long-term action, and that's going to be a challenge. Alexis Strauss and I met with Dave Williams, head of wastewater at East Bay MUD, recently, and he does view that there is a solution, but it's going to definitely be a challenge, and it's going to potentially require some hard choices by the cities and East Bay MUD how to move forward. And he wasn't necessarily asking for more time, but I think the fact that all of, it's not only the East Bay communities, but all of our wastewater systems are very leaky in the East Bay MUD communities. He said that essentially they have can see 14-to-1 increases. In other words, during a storm, they can almost like that get flows 14 times their dry weather flow. He says we could manage if we could cut that in half to 7-to-1, and so that's going to be the challenge moving forward.
Yeah, you know, Bruce, in Marin County, I'm a design engineer for this sort of thing. And 15-to-1 is what we design for, to carry capacity and not have it overflow.
Yeah, I think moving forward, that's one way to look at it if you're doing in design. But if you're retrofitting, you have to look at, okay, what can the system accomplish?
Right. That's right. It's just a matter of, this is what we have, and I got a project, and this is what I'm going to design for so I don't spill sewage. Yeah. But, yes, the planning has to go in up front.
Right. And this ties in with the need for infrastructure investments. We also just this week had a meeting with representatives of the City of Richmond, and East Bay MUD was part of this, and the City of Richmond recognizes that it needs $150 million to upgrade and bring its wastewater treatment plant into condition moving forward to remain in compliance. They also view a collection system that has about a 10-to-1 rate. And so they're looking at, is this the time to say, okay, we're going to have to put a lot of money into the wastewater treatment plant, a lot of money into the collection system. Should we look at the option of connecting our system to the East Bay MUD system and see if that might be a more cost-effective and ultimately a better way to treat wastewater? And so I think for once, we do have a lot of the wastewater community looking at the need moving forward to address their infrastructure in such a way that they can get multiple benefits out of it, and not only recognize that they're going to have to put a lot of investment into this, but that there are opportunities, cycling back to the energy production, that there's opportunities out of all of this to and maybe even plug into some of the funds that come out of cap and trade, as Dr. Singh brought up, that moving forward, we're going to have to bring this to the public to demonstrate that this is a responsibility, but this is also an opportunity to move forward and reap the benefits that are available there.
Bruce, maybe this is an item that you want to think about having a workshop on. With all due respect to Steve, who I look at 3-to-1 as kind of, you really can't get a system any tighter than that. That's a really the nature of what you've got with construction in the ground. But I also think that you've got real problems when you get over 6 or 7. And those are kind of the numbers that I have floating around in my head in terms of what's a reasonable level of maintenance in the system. I might be wrong. I got a lot of years doing this, but not on a design basis. And I think in terms of cost effectiveness and what it means, dilute wastewater is not good for a sewage treatment plant and its operation.
I do have a comment in response.
So
we'll have dueling engineers here in a minute. Hang on.
So, and I'm not saying I'm right. I'm saying that maybe the cost effectiveness question and the net downstream impact, if we're going to be able to focus attention on the priorities and decide whether it's more important to upgrade the sewage treatment plant and perhaps build more storage capacity, or the collection systems and deal with leakage, we probably should have a discussion with stakeholders and expertise on what are the most cost-effective approaches and what are the ranges. So I think this is an important strategic direction question. I'm not saying that my rules of thumb are right. I'm saying when I look at our data and I see 3-to-1 or 4-to-1, I don't really worry. And when I see more than 10-to-1, I go, what's going on?
Yeah. Well, and that's where,
and believe me, it's not a defensive posture. What you do is you look at what are the factors that lead to this, you know. And we say leaky pipes, roots, and all that. But in Marin County, you have to look at the topography, the hydrography, the geology.
The location of the lines.
And location, you know. And what's the story of Marin County is there's a very tight geologic formation. So when you put, and then the design of a sewer trench is permeable. It allows water to go there. And then you also have the most rainfall in the Bay Area in Kentfield in terms of the inches per year. So you have a steep topography from, you know, the uplift of the coastal range. So you have like a hydraulic jump effect in terms of runoff from that steep slope. So all those factors combine to supercharge the trench of the sewer. That's where the water will go because it's a low point. So it creates pressure toward the sewer. So you might even a better designed and lined sewer system will suffer from infiltration in a setting like that. So it's, you have to deal with nature.
I'd like to make some comment. I think Jim has brought out a very important point, and I also agree with Steve that we have looked at the topography and other hydrological factors. But I have seen bridges built over there and huge pipes underneath. I never seen in my lifetime a flowing pool. I have seen that condition. You can design for an extreme flood, but I think there should be proportion of how much money we spend for this purpose. You can overbuild it. Why can't we provide some temporary storage, underground storage, some big pipes or something, rather than the provide 15-to-1 ratio or 100-to-1 ratio? Where is the limit? Is this not waste of public money? I think we should, this is called system analysis.
Yeah.
We should optimize it. We look at the benefit and the cost and see when the benefit exceeds the cost line. At that point, we should cut it off. I think it must make sense. This, we can go to extreme point in environmental protection, but environmental protection doesn't mean they're taking an extremist position. You know, how can you protect it unless you design every system for extreme event? And look at this. Is there a limit? And if you go through the probability theorem, extreme limit event does not have a limit. So I really believe that rather than using arbitrarily a 15-to-1 or 7-to-1 ratio, we should optimize the system in design and conserve the money rather than throwing down money in the concrete and the structures. And I don't think too many structures are good for the environment anyway. So there must be a limit. I'll also look at the energy generation, recycling, and all those factors, all the benefits and all the losses. And then we go on the basis of that. So I do believe in the system analysis and optimization process on the whole, including topography, the hydrology, the climate, and other factors involved.
Thank you. Board Member Elihu, you're a senior engineer in seniority and age, too, I guess.
We have to do the analysis, as Ram was saying, and see what is the most effective system to do. And that's always being done. I'm sure any new design is done on this basis. But today we have the existing system, and that's a big challenge. It's not really the new one. The new one coming is based on sound engineering, and is done. But the existing system, that's a big challenge.
Thank you. Vice Chair, you want to get in this engineer battle? We have to remind ourselves we are policy, not operations. Right. You guys are operations out there.
I never thought I'd say we had too many engineers on the board. But,
right. But
it sounds like
you guys are from the regulated community for a moment there. Anyway, continue on, please.
And I was going to wrap up with tying into what came up at the chair's meeting that we had a couple of weeks ago is a report from Rob Eagle, our state board's director of legislative affairs. There is legislation that is considered part of the governor's budget proposal that would do a number of things relative to the boards and the board structure, including reducing the number of board members from 9 to 7, have 6 of those 7 board members be water quality experts and 1 from the public, and get rid of the other historic designations that all of you serve under. Also of interest in that legislation would be that the chair would be appointed by the governor. The vice chair would be elected by the board. A number of the board chairs commented on that, saying, gee, if the system of board chairmanship is not broken, why fix it? And having seen the speed of appointments being made, I guess the question is, would board chairs be appointed all that quickly? So maybe in essence, the vice chair would be the de facto chair. But just bringing that up, also that legislation would include the consolidation of the Region 7, the desert, essentially the desert region, the Colorado Basin region. The bulk of that region would be consolidated with the San Diego region, Region 9, and a portion of it would be consolidated with the Lahontan region, Region 6. And so that wouldn't mean that all of a sudden all of, you know, the office and the staff would go away. It would just be parceled out so that there would be essentially fewer board members. So that obviously does not affect this board. One concern is, though, that as you start tinkering with board boundaries, does that sort of open up the door to tinker statewide with the boundaries and change the system? So that's been some of the concern. This legislation is considered part of the budget, and so it would be part of a trailer bill. In other words, if and when the budget was adopted, there's always a number of trailer bills that go in get considered and adopted to implement the budget, and this would be part of that. But the idea would be that it would go into effect January 1, 2013. So we'll keep you posted on what that, how that is evolving and what that means coming down. But I think in the near term, that probably means that we are unlikely to see much action in terms of further board appointments, because the governor's appointment secretary recognizes that there's no need to go, you know, full appointments if you're potentially going to end up at seven. Obviously, we're not at seven, but I think there's some thinking that this is a low priority to make appointments until it's resolved what the size of the board would be. So so that is out on the table. That's, I think, I'll wrap up my comments there.
Now, what is the bill number over here? We can send some comments about it.
It hasn't gotten there yet, I don't think.
Is the budget
bill? We'll have to figure out where that, what that is, and we'll let you know.
Well, I can tell you one thing. You know, you all well know I'm not an engineer, but whoever set up this damn table today, I got this thing here driving me nuts. So if you see me shuffling, Ray, help me. Let's get back to where we belong. Jesus, criminy. It feels like my dog between my legs here all day long here. My God. Okay, so, I don't know what's happened to this setup here today, but it's kind of cattywampus.
That's why we have rain in April. You know?
That's right, so the farmer could be here. So at this time, we'll do swearing in, and all relevant evidence that any person's desires to be considered by this board must be introduced at this hearing, first by the board staff, second by the dischargers, and third by public agencies, and fourth by any other interested persons. The board and board counsel may ask questions to clarify the testimony of a witness at any time. Cross-examination of any witnesses by others will be allowed following completion of direct testimony by all persons. Each person testifying will commence by stating his or her name, whom he or she represents, and whether he or she took the oath of office to tell the truth. The hearings will not be conducted according to technical rule of evidence. The board will accept any evidence or testimony that is reasonably relevant to the issues. All board files, exhibit, and agenda materials pertaining to this matter will be made part of the record of this proceeding. Additional written material will be made part of the record at the discretion of the board. Those testifying in the hearing will now rise or raise their hand, please. Do you promise to tell the truth?
So do.
Very good. So I'll shuffle back around here a little bit more.
Okay, item five is the uncontested items calendar. We have five items on there. We have no supplementals.
And no cards.
I'm not aware of any cards. So I would recommend adoption of item five as is.
Yeah, and I might mention that representatives are here from the different era agenda items, and I was speaking to the manager of the rodeo district, and we were talking about the earlier this morning about uncontested, and I think we have been working really hard to show that we can get these on the uncontested calendar, and thank you for all the work that staff does to put in, and also the discharger to definitely ensure that we can meet those things, and I appreciate getting that caught up there. So, go ahead.
On that, is Marsha Lau here?
Yeah, way in the back.
Would you stand up? I read these things pretty carefully, and I just thought this was a really, I don't remember you having something here before. This was a really good job. You did a really good job of listening to the discharger, and I just wanted to thank you.
Marcia's recently moved into the NPDES division from the toxic cleanup division, and so that's part of our, as you alluded to, the training, our effort of moving people around, and we always find that when people shift around, they have new eyes looking at things, and Marcia pointed out a few things in our permit that we're good with fresh eyes looking at how we can improve.
And I think on item E, I mean, while we're discussing this quick, It's the first time I've come across the year one.
We actually do that. Have we done that typically a lot? Typically in the spring each.
Okay.
Just each year.
Forget it. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But, no, I wish. You know, naturally, November, December, January, February, we had no rain. And now when it's time to actually go plant things, it's raining. So good thing we have a meeting today. So
I'll move the approval of the uncontested calendar.
Second.
It's been moved in second. A roll call vote, please, Mary.
Aye.
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 Aye. So ordered. And moving on.
Item six is a presentation by San Francisco Public Utilities Commission about their evolving program on on-site non-potable reuse of water. And I'd like our long-term colleague, long-term friend of mine, and former executive officer here, Steve Ritchie, is going to make the presentation. So there is a handout. I think you received a copy of the presentation. Unless he's technologically challenged to get it. There it is.
Yep. Thanks, Bruce. Steve Ritchie, the Assistant General Manager of the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission for Water, and it's actually been a very interesting morning, kind of strolling down memory lane, as many of these issues don't go away. There's lots of activity, but kind of some core issues don't.
What size pipe do you want to install?
That brought back a lot of different memories, some of which were not real pleasant, but on behalf of San Francisco, as somebody who operates a combined sewer system, we did make decisions about how big, and as far as infrastructure, we're now beginning to embark on a program that could run as much as $6+ billion to revamp the sewer system and treatment plants throughout the city, and that's going to be probably a 20-year program, and it's a huge deal, because what that means as rate increases for our public is going to be a huge deal. So that's a large thing ahead of us. And we're just about two-thirds of the way through a $4.5 billion investment in the water system for San Francisco, and that was another huge deal. So taking care of the infrastructure is a big deal. And also from the operator's point of view, the comments about staff development, workforce development in the industry is another big deal. Who are going to be the operators in the next generation? We have tons of retirements coming up, and you know, not necessarily seeing the machinists, technicians who are going to do all the work that make all these things, you know, actually function out there. So we all have a lot of challenges ahead of us out there. But I will say that your comment about staff rotation and things like that, that's one of the best things I ever took from the Water Board. I think I worked on everything at least once, and I really got a lot out of that. Plus, and sorry, Tam, my education at Stanford helped quite a bit, too. As it did Bruce, as it did Steve, and others. But I'm not here to talk about collegial rivalries. I'm here to talk about our on-site non-potable water use program here in San Francisco, and basically going to cover what on-site non-potable water use is going on now or proposed, that we're coming forward with an ordinance to codify the regulatory process for on-site treatment, and we're actually going to be going out to promote more on-site non-potable water use within the city. You know, we've all talked about recycled water in a big way, but this is getting down to the building level and what happens there, and are there opportunities to do good things. First, as the head of the water department for San Francisco, we see ourselves as water resources stewards. And that's not just taking water off of our watersheds, the Tuolumne River and Alameda watershed and the Peninsula watersheds, but also developing local water supplies in San Francisco through groundwater development and recycled water development. Actually, later this year, and happy to invite everybody, we will actually be applying recycled water in San Francisco in effect for the first time since 1981. when we had an old plant out in Golden Gate Park that had been creaking along for years and couldn't meet modern standards, we took it out. And San Francisco hasn't done any recycled water since then, except within the wastewater treatment plants. And that's going to change starting in September, I believe. We expect at the Harding Park Golf Course to apply recycled water there. We're also doing a lot to reduce demands in the water system through conservation and use of residential gray water. That's something that a pilot program has started going forward in the last year, thanks to some changes in the plumbing code that were a long time in coming. I still remember back in the drought in 87, when I heard people talking about doing gray water, and then they had the plumbing inspector from San Jose on television said, "No way, people can't do that." And finally, now, just about 2 years ago, finally the plumbing code did change to allow residential gray water to be used. So that's a step forward out there. And then again, we're also looking at how can we minimize sewer impacts, because San Francisco is a combined sewer system. We have large boxes to collect lots of water and meter into the system, but there's always overflows that occur. And so can we find ways to reduce inflows into the sewer system through stormwater management, either through low-impact development activities or, as we're doing just throughout the sewer system improvement program, this whole $6 billion effort, can we shave off some of the peaks in different ways to minimize the number of overflows? So we're looking at that as well. But all this fits in what we think of as the water resources package in San Francisco. There are examples of on-site non-potable water use in other places. New York, Portland, Seattle, and Tokyo all have different ones. In particular, New York, if you explore it on the web, the Solaire high-rise residences is actually, it's almost verging on an eco-district of use of recycling water within the buildings for wastewater use in toilets, cooling towers, and irrigation. So it's a fascinating development, and one of the things I'm going to talk about that they had to work through there is, okay, let's do this, but who regulates it? How do we make this system work? And that's what we're starting to face now in San Francisco as well, because we have a number of different proposals in San Francisco for different things, not the least of which is the new PUC building at 525 Golden Gate Avenue that we're constructing right now, and we actually plan to move in late June in that. And there we'll actually be treating black water and gray water through a living machine that will be in the lobby, and in fact we may be able to arrange a tour as it's being brought online now, I think with dog food and powdered milk or something like that to kind of seed the system. But it's actually a treatment facility in the building that will, the water will be recycled and used for flushing toilets. And that's going to be a big thing that's out there. One of the things we faced is, so who needs to approve this thing? So we face that, and we'll talk about how we've done that. But also PG&E at one of their facilities is looking at taking foundation drainage and using it in toilets there. For the Transbay Transit Center, they plan to use rainwater and gray water for toilet flushing there, and also for a a five-acre park they're developing as part of that development. And Moscone Center will be taking their foundation drainage and using it for irrigation. And we've left a little gray spot there in the corner. Salesforce.com is moving to San Francisco in a big way. They just decided rather than build their own facility, they're going to rent because their staff is growing too fast. But they actually had a very innovative set of proposals for a four-building development that they were working on there. And hopefully those plans will stay alive for that area where those kind of ideas can come forward. But again, these are people who are doing this without incentives from anybody, without regulation. It's just the right thing to do for LEED certification and other things. So these proposals will continue to come forward as we see over time. So the challenges that the developers see is the lack of regulations and process. They come forward to the planning department and the building department and say, okay, we want to do this. And they're met by kind of a blank stare. We don't know how to do this. So current regulations actually address only two sources, municipally supplied recycled water, you know, the big scale stuff, and on-site gray water, as I mentioned, but they don't actually deal with things yet on a state basis. So we've been working on defining pathways for authority and oversight and ongoing maintenance of such systems. We think that's the opportunity for helping the business community and others deal with what they'd like to do. So what we've developed is an interim process for on-site non-potable water use projects. We, you know, as the water and wastewater utility in San Francisco, working together with the Department of Public Health and the Department of Building Inspection, have developed a process for water quality and monitoring requirements, coordination between the agencies, because we all know from experience as public agencies, coordination is one of the things we're always beat up about, that you guys don't work well enough together, you send us in goose chases, and this doesn't work. So we're trying to make sure that's a lot clearer. And actually, if you go to sfwater.org/NP, you can actually see this laid out on our website that we make available to people. So for the interim process, the developer submits a general project description to us and an on-site treatment system engineering report to the Department of Public Health and the plumbing plans themselves to the Department of Building Inspection. Department of Public Health is really the technical lead in terms of a letter of agreement regarding safe operation of the on-site treatment system. What are the standards they have to meet? And they can actually enforce this under the general nuisance abatement portions of the city's health codes. They don't have to have a special health code section to protect public health. They can just set the general protection of public health as the basis for regulating this way. And so they issue a letter that says, this is what you shall do. And that is required prior to the Department of Building Inspection giving their final inspection and sign-off. And both agencies are very clear on that, and that same message is communicated to the developers, which they're happy to work with. As long as they know what to do, they'll be okay. So we're looking at how do we expand that and make it more useful. So we're looking at developing a city ordinance to establish regulatory oversight within San Francisco to direct the departments to administer the program, establish water quality standards, and provide oversight during construction of these kind of facilities. We would codify that regulatory framework to streamline project approval and implementation so there's no having to run around. In fact, we met with a couple of developers at SPUR, the Planet and Urban Research outfit in San Francisco, and their first answer was, great. This is really what we need more than anything else. We don't need lots of other things, but we need to know what to do. And so we think this will also help us to go forward promoting on-site non-potable water use and net zero, you know, within a building water concepts by providing financial incentives for appropriate on-site treatment systems. Sometimes a little bit of money helps too. And so we're exploring that as having a grant program that we might make available to allow folks to get some financial incentives to do what might be the right thing. So this is just a graphical representation of program administration, public health protection, and construction with the three agencies having their particular roles, but that all three have to be part of it. It's not something that the PUC can do by itself or DBI can do by itself or public health can do by itself. And I'll go into each of these in a little bit of detail. First, for the PUC role, it's just general administration of it, that we identify water uses and non-potable demands that might exist, and we're developing a calculator that they can use to help calculate how much non-potable use there might be on a site. Then we just develop a system for tracking and reporting potable offsets. Actually, we've just done a report in a larger way about citywide what kind of potable offset can we have through different types of water that might be used out there. We also want to provide technical outreach and support for developers, and how do I do this? What are my resources? What can I take advantage of? And again, we're looking at financial incentives for certain kinds of developments to help get them over the top in terms of making a good decision. For DPH, their job is protection of public health and setting standards. So if there was black water reuse, and that's not something we're necessarily pushing out there, but that we've taken on, for example, the San Francisco, thinking we can do it. And I will advise that Tommy Mawala, head of our wastewater program, said, I think this is great. Where's the bypass line in case it doesn't work? So there's always the pragmatic piece of this, that you have to be able to deal with those kind of things. But that those would be, you know, consistent with Title 22 for disinfected tertiary recycled water. Commercial gray water and rainwater limits would be consistent with the forthcoming 2013 state plumbing code revisions that are being worked on right now. And there's a special committee working on the gray water and rainwater aspects of what might be in the plumbing code. And we're working closely with them as well. And DPH would then set criteria for foundation drainage and other sources and end uses that, if for some reason they're not addressed at the state level, that we make sure we deal with in San Francisco. And then they would review and approve the on-site non-potable reuse systems and establish the monitoring and reporting requirements to the local health department, similar to what happens with septic tanks. Those are regulated by local health departments. I think our long-term hope would that there wouldn't have to be further state oversight beyond the plumbing code and other things in terms of dealing with regulation of these activities. And then the Department of Building Inspection, basically plan checks and plumbing permits. Does it work? Does it have backflow prevention? Things like that. And then ensure compliance with applicable plumbing codes, again, cross-connection control, and a bypass to sewer in case something goes wrong. Always make sure the safety valve is there. For system construction, one of the things we're pushing hard is common pipe for all non-potable applications. You may not be exposed to it, but there was actually there's been a series of discussions in the recycled water industry about purple pipe. And purple pipe should be reserved for municipal recycled water. You know, we can't let other kinds of water get in there because that might be wrong. So we've tried to work through, how do we make purple pipe work for different kinds of non-potable water? And I think we're there with the industry, but it's taken some work to get there.
Have you noticed that the purple pipe turns white after enough time in the sun?
Yeah. That's why you bury it and hide it.
So does that mean, say, foundation drain water could go into a purple pipe? This is your...
Yeah. You might have to identify it in some way with some special tape on the pipe or some written words on what it is that you could paint out with purple paint when you change the type of water that was in there, but at least something that allows, the community to say, don't confuse me. Just let me, build something with something that I can understand.
So the understanding is this can't be used for drinking, but it can be used.
It can't be used. The whole point is it's not used for drinking water. Until it turns white, then you never know what's going to happen to it. And one of the things, of course, we're looking at is municipal recycled water as makeup or backup supply. So if that supply is not there, that we're working towards developing recycled water to come forward. And, of course, if recycled water is not available, then, yes, you could use potable water in the purple pipe just to get water to the function that you're getting it to. But either way, the same backflow protection would be required on the purple pipe. And again, this is where we think the 2013 plumbing code is headed, and we're working hard to try to make sure it gets there. So the next step for us, we are really just trying to provide assistance to new construction projects to replace those potable uses for toilet flushing. I mean, frankly, Tuolumne River water shouldn't be used for flushing toilets. We should be using something else if we've got it available. We're just working at making sure it's available and using on-site rainwater, gray water, and foundation drainage as the priorities. We're looking hardest at this for new large commercial, mixed-use, and multifamily residential developments. We're not talking about a program for individual households yet. We think that's a little too much to bite off. There are people interested in it, but you're looking at a level of expertise that is above your typical homeowner. In fact, just on the gray water front, we've been disappointed with the progress there because as homeowners find out what it takes to actually do it, they're not quite there. It turns out the garden's on the wrong side of the house from where the washing machine is, so it takes an extra 100 feet of pipe to get there. So head loss and also headache of just installing it. So it's things like that where, again, at the individual level, the littlest things will kind of stand in the way of doing the right thing. Where on a building where you have a building manager and a building engineer and things like that, they can deal with the facilities. That's their job. Again, the non-potable demands we're looking at primarily are toilet and urinal flushing and irrigation. We could look at cooling water as well, although we think toilet flushing is probably a larger use in San Francisco, but we're still trying to get data on that to make sure we're hitting the target properly. And again, rainwater, gray water, and foundation, and others if approved. If somebody really has a good system for dealing with black water, we think we should find a way to make that happen. And we're looking at a financial incentive size threshold for developments of 100,000 square feet or larger, which is basically in San Francisco in what we call our look-ahead report. Those yellow dots are all of the developments that are on the list for being about 100,000 square feet or more. They're obviously centered in the downtown and the Civic Center area, but there are some scattered around. But these are kind of the real opportunities, we think, for somebody to actually make it pay for them to put in on-site reuse within their development. So the total potential there by 2035 is about 110 million gallons a year. And that would be out of 60 developments total. When you get that down to an MGD basis, it tends to be, you know, not a huge number, but it's still a lot of water in the grand scheme of things. And the estimated building and costs and benefits for 100,000 square foot buildings, we think the cost is about 3 to 4% for actually putting in on site use, but that there would be water and wastewater savings on rates of about $34,000 a year. So that there are some offsets there that can be accomplished to make it economically more attractive. And most importantly, I think for a lot of developers, this can lead to more points for LEED certification, which I think is very attractive to a lot of buildings in San Francisco. So we basically think this is the right thing to do because we can reduce the use of drinking water for non-potable purposes, further diversify our water supplies, decrease combined sewer impacts for new developments, and San Francisco, you know, likes to think of itself as a leader in some things, and I think here we can be one, and so we're pretty excited about this. And I'd be happy to answer any questions about this or about anything else we're doing for that matter.
What I was saying that you said you can use for irrigation purpose, you can use in Golden Gate Bridge, but rest of the big buildings over there, they don't have any landscaping, almost nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Is it right?
Which buildings?
The big buildings in the downtown area.
Yeah, a lot of them don't have landscaping, but they do have lots of toilets. So that's where the real emphasis is.
Mm-hmm. And do you include a Golden Gate Park?
Golden Gate Park actually is for, we're proposing recycled water from the Oceanside Water Pollution Control Plant to be piped up to Golden Gate Park, and we're hoping that project will be online by about 2018.
You may want to show your slide. You have the recycled water.
There. Yeah, the purple outline here is the recycled water ordinance zone. That is where San Francisco in 1991 passed an ordinance to require buildings of a certain size and landscaped areas to be dual plumbed in expectation of recycled water being delivered eventually. So they're really fundamentally divided into two zones, the west side and the east side. The west side is primarily landscape irrigation, Golden Gate Park, Lincoln Park, the Presidio golf course in particular. And on the east side, it's really in buildings, where you're talking about dual plumbing for the buildings to actually accomplish toilet flushing and things like that. So that was passed in 1991, and you know, because things move slow in general on recycled water, and things really move slow in San Francisco sometimes to get community consensus, these projects are still moving forward. And I think, like I said, for the West Side project, we hope to have that online by 2018, and for the East Side by 2020.
My quick question would be, we're hearing a lot about water conservation, which is wonderful, but it's impacting the water rate costs for the districts or whoever.
Mm-hmm.
And in this situation here, you touched on it briefly, would that have a major impact on, I don't know, do you set your wastewater rates on the amount of flow of your fresh water? Is that how San Francisco
does? Yeah, San Francisco sets water rates based on the amount of water used,
right,
and sets wastewater rates also based on the amount of water used, and individuals can get an allowance for landscape irrigation if they have a lot of irrigation going on there.
Well, I guess where I was going, it could have an impact on...
Yeah, like every water and wastewater utility, our costs are primarily fixed. There's very little variable cost. So decreases in the volume of water use, if it's based on usage, means rates will go up in accordance. So your bill, you know, in any for a particular resident, probably wouldn't change. It's just the rate per unit of water would go up, the units would go down, bill would stay the same. Throughout California, all water agencies and wastewater agencies are dealing with this phenomena due to the reduced water use over the last several years. And lots of folks are looking at, you want to keep use as part of the billing process, so that it promotes conservation, but probably lots of people are looking to more fixed charges as kind of the base rate, so that there's not that rate fluctuation. Because even though my bill's not going to go up, I'm still irritated if I see a 20% rate increase, you know, because we've all gotten better at using our water. It's a challenge for the water industry throughout.
That's right. It's systemic.
Vice Chair?
This has been very interesting. Sprinkled throughout your presentation were references to potential financial and other incentives, mm-hmm. and then also things that are create costs and hassle. And I wonder if you could just sort of review those side by side. For example, you said that there might be for these buildings about a $34,000 a year savings in cost for buying water and treating, dealing with the wastewater.
Right.
That would be an incentive. LEED certification is an incentive. If you have a grant program, that's an incentive. That would be on one side of the ledger, and
right.
perhaps you could add more to that list. On the other side of the ledger, perhaps there's an additional construction cost, at least
yeah,
for areas
about,
not
about
in those
4%
purple zones,
is what we, what 4%. We estimate it to be. And what's and then, not included in here yet, we haven't got a good handle on what the operational cost for the facilities might be. We want, we're still working on developing some, you know, standard rules of thumb on what the operational cost might be, which, you know, the savings in water and wastewater thing may directly offset the operational cost. We just don't know for sure yet.
So given this ledger, mm-hmm. both sides, do you think that's enough to drive this to happen by itself? I mean, I guess part of the answer is no, otherwise you wouldn't be considering a grant program. But maybe you can just speak on that a little bit.
We're starting to roll this out now with a lot of different folks. We've had conversations with some in the development community and with the mayor's office and others about how we can best make this happen. And, you know, the ideas of financial incentives have been talked about, but certainly regulatory streamlining is as a real key in the center of this. The idea of making it mandatory in some way has been talked about, but in the current business climate, you know, I think people want to avoid, you know, dictating they shall do this, and so we also might be looking at the Green Building Ordinance and seeing how this can be used to enhance a building's rating in the LEED system. Can we work with USGBC and others to bump up their points for improved water use that would allow people to garner more points there? That's another possibility. But all these, you know, probably over the next 6 months, we will have lots of discussions with different folks and see, you know, have we got a package that actually makes sense both for the city as the city government and for the development community as folks who will be building buildings and would be trying to carry these things out. And by the end of this process, probably, you know, have something introduced to the Board of Supervisors in the middle of this year, have some dialogue about it, and by the end of the year have an ordinance in place that we think works for everybody.
And I think, as you could see, what we're all hearing is it's a pretty hot time in San Francisco on the east side anyway for building and development, and everyone wants to move over there and redo. So it's probably as good a time as ever right now to work towards this.
I came back to San Francisco in 2009, and when you looked out of our office window, you could see one crane on the skyline. That was the one building our building, 525 Golden Gate. Now you look out, there's, you know, 20 cranes going. So people are building stuff now, and things don't show signs of slowing down currently.
That's great. Board Member Moore?
Yeah. Well, thanks, Dr. Young, for the incentive question. That was very interesting points there about what drives things besides the desire to do the right thing for Tuolumne Water. You know, what's really going to get this stuff in the ground? In terms of some of the nuts and bolts of the implementation, which are really critical, because I was one of those glassy-eyed stares out there, you know, when people would ask the water board staff, what do we do for gray water? There's the plumbing code. So that was a big breakthrough, as you pointed out,
right.
You know, the way to get into the buildings. What I saw in terms of some of the details of implementation was, you know, getting Department of Public Health in the city involved. And really, my question is, you know, it relates to the institutional capacity capacity issues, you know, and but also institutional acceptance. You know, the folks that do the day-to-day work, they got to believe, you know, that this is feasible. It's not going to be a headache for their day-to-day work. So I was curious, how has it been going from both an internal standpoint with staff implementing the program at Department of Public Health, and also with the regulated community, quote unquote, you know, in terms of the builders? Is that going well with the monitoring, and are we learning as we go and coming up with optimizing that regulatory process?
Yeah, and actually I'd take the opportunity to introduce Paula Kehoe, our manager of water resources back here, who has been spearheading this and really going through those conversations with folks and finding what works and what's not. And frankly, the PUC has been excited about doing this. DPH was a little less excited up front, and frankly, DBI was a little stodgier about the whole thing. And Paula and her folks have done a lot of work to bring both of them along and say, yeah, we can make this work. And then also interacting with the business community on finding, you know, what things are going to work and what things aren't going to work. And the message loud and clearest was clarity and consistency and predictability were the big things that they've been looking for. But again, we have more meetings that ahead with them and others,
yeah.
And there are some existing programs out there that they would like to see us do some improvements on how we manage stormwater in San Francisco, for example. There have been some bumps in the road on that, and I think we need, as part of going forward with this, we need to tweak the other programs so that they work for everybody.
Yeah, that's right. And then finally, on the incentive question, you know, there's the LEED, which is interesting to me that would create such an incentive, but I guess there are benefits. But how about, you know, this overall mandate out of the 09 law for the state water, you know, in terms of the 20% urban use reduction? Does this fit into that for the city and county of San Francisco?
Well, truth be told, and very proud of it, we actually already comply with whichever of the SBXs it was,
right,
that called for 20% by 2020 if your water use is below 100 gallons per capita per day on gross water use. You're already there, and for us in San Francisco, consistently over the last 5 years, it's been below 90 gallons per capita per day. So our water use is very low. Actually, residential use is 51 gallons per capita per day in San Francisco. So it's extraordinarily low. So we actually already comply with the standard.
So there was no incentive.
No,
from that.
No more softball, Steve. They already wrote a letter of support for you. All right.
not from that perspective, but going forward, actually looking at projections out to 2035, you know, we're already at that low water use. Our demand in 2035 of the total demand, 24% additional out of that demand, that total demand, will be met through both active and passive conservation by 2035, because, you know, we're not stopping. Lots of things are in the works to happen. So water, I'm actually stunned by that every time I look at that number, because we already have such low water use, it's going to get lower.
Mm-hmm.
Hard to imagine, but it will.
Those valley farmers will take it. Don't worry.
You know, I would like to... Thank you, John. You know, I'd like to add a few words of mine about water conservation. In old days, these huge apartment complexes were built, and water was cheap. And what they did, they have a central water supply by the owner, and the owner pays for it. And the hot water, also owner pays, they were plumbed like that. And the tenants are very irresponsible. Because they don't have to pay, they really waste water. If they're brushing the teeth, they keep on running. Everything. And I always thought that you can conserve a lot of water. And a lot of apartment buildings all over. I mean, I see in every town there are apartments, thousands and thousands of apartment buildings. If some incentive was available to the owners, it's costly. Plumbing is very costly. That the meter individually, every apartment, for the water use, and tenant has to pay just like they pay for PG&E, I think you can cut down a lot of water use, because they have to conserve and they realize that they are paying for it. Now, that's a different department from what we are doing. But this is, I always thought that this process, I don't know what it will cost to do it, how much incentive landlords have to be given, how tax benefit has to be given, so that it will make it palatable or affordable to do that.
It's not a different department. It's my department. You know, the meters are all ours. We're replacing all the meters in San Francisco, actually, to try to get them to be more efficient. But sub-metering, frankly, in the water industry is a very hot topic because a meter installation typically costs about $6,000. And then there's the cost of reading the meters as well. So there's lots of debate ongoing, and legislatively it's been talked about for a while of going to sub-meters, and it hasn't gotten there yet, and I don't know if it ever will. But it continues to be a subject of debate in the water community.
Yeah, and
thank you.
Yeah, as we're concluding here, on a personal level, since the water people here, you and Paula, for many years I had that wonderful SFPUC history book of our water systems. And a couple of years ago I lent it out to that education system for a project, and I've never gotten it back. So I want another one, you guys. And if you're moving, you got to have one in the cabinets there someplace because I want our grandchildren in the future to have that someday, to see where this water all started from and the history and the Raker Act and all those good things that you guys saw all maneuvered through over the years. So, right, Bruce? I don't know if we got one in this
book. I'll check and see if we have six or seven.
There's probably a lot of things as they move.
we're heavily purging right now. I just did my desk yesterday afternoon, which is usually a disaster, and I can show pictures that it's actually clean now.
Well, you know, we thank you for this presentation, and I've always said it, you know, on our side of the bay, which we are a user of San Francisco PUC water, it's just, to me, it's the greatest system around for all of us. It's a wonderful system, and they've done a great job. And, you know, for us to buy an inch and a half water meter from our district, it's $50,000, you know. And so we're hoping after 50-some years of our family being on the property to actually be able to hook up to municipal water soon after dealing with a neighbor issue for the last 3 years. So we're getting real close, but we'll be buying that water. I don't know if my wife will pay on time, but at least we'll be buying it. So, so thank you, Steve, and thank you, SFPUC. Bruce, yeah,
wrap up. For the board, where I see this going is, one, obviously, I'm sure the PUC is not looking for opportunities to be regulated by this board for this operation. Steve did allude to the fact that, by and large, this board has turned over regulation of on-site wastewater treatment systems, commonly known as septic tanks and all, to the counties. And in this instance, we're certainly not looking to expand our regulatory authority or oversight. We already regulate the wastewater treatment plant, and essentially when you're doing this type of use and reuse, in most cases, especially for urinals and toilets, that's where it's going to end up. So we're already covering it. So we really want to look at how we don't have to get into any increased role of regulation here, and I think what's been outlined by Steve gives us the confidence that this would be done at the local level, the public health aspects through the Department of Health, and that it would be following the Title 23 regulations and gray water use regulations, and that would be sufficient for our needs. More broadly, though, I think this is starting to set in place a model that can be applied elsewhere around the region and the state, and certainly has the potential to be very significant, recognizing that San Francisco is a combined system, that stormwater and wastewater all end up in the same place, but elsewhere around the region, that's not the case. And so this has potential benefits for our stormwater programs. And as he said, this ties into the low-impact development. And I would say that, as Dr. Young pointed out, the 3-4% costs, that probably includes some of the expenses that buildings elsewhere around the region are finding for stormwater of 1 to 2%. And so that may all be wrapped in there. And so what we're talking about here may not be all that significant on top of what new developments elsewhere around the region may need to do for their stormwater controls. Because obviously if you're collecting rainwater and reusing it, you don't have to do other types of stormwater controls. So I think there's lots of opportunities here. And as I commented earlier about the wet weather problems, as Steve says, this is not necessarily going to be a massive change in their flow to their facilities, but it can be part of the solution to the problem. And so I think this is something we'll want to dangle out there to other communities to say this is an opportunity to include as part of your toolbox to address the wet weather problems. How do you sort of start at the source, as it were, and treat it and reuse it up front and reduce the amount of water that you have to deal with in the system? So I think it has lots of potentials.
And if I may, I just really support those statements in terms of making this an implementable program statewide, you know, how important it is to have a model that facilitates this implementation, which is consistent with the low-impact development direction that this board and others have made. So, you know, here's how you get there. So I put in the plug that, for sure, we don't play an overt regulatory role, but is within the purview of the regional and state boards to guide, you know, provide guidance on these decisions at this low level, you know, and at a higher level. So there needs to be a linkage. And we do that with our basin plan, you know, to the triennial review. We look at regulatory actions, but we also look at getting the basin plan information correct, you know, in terms of guiding the public on how to implement gray water to meet LID requirements. So it's not regulatory. It just gives them a guidepost. And I think it's a critical role for us to play statewide, but to empower work at the local level to actually get these things done. Because otherwise, you know, you don't deal with the plumbing code, you don't deal with the Department of Public Health at this county, it will not happen. So I think there is a role for us to play. But it's not, you know, you have to get a permit type role.
Thanks. Very good. Thank you.
I would suspect that Steve came up with smart and innovative ideas long before he went to Stanford.
All right.
Thank you.
Enough. So thank all of you, and thank you, Steve, and good seeing you and Paula, and we appreciate the work doing in San Francisco. I don't think we have any further business today. And looks like May could be busy, so be prepared for May. Hard to say May already here. So thank all of you. We're adjourned.
Thank you.